You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
All right, welcome to the Archaeology Show. I'm your host, Chris Webster. And today we're going to talk to Dr. Lamont Dobson about his TV series, America from the Ground Up. Find it online at americasarchaeology.org. The phone lines are live right now, so call in with your questions at 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to at ArchaeoWebby or at KNVC_radio. And you can post on our Facebook page at facebook.com/ArcPodNet. The co-founder of the APN, Tristan Boyle, will be monitoring all the socials today from Scotland, and he'll be feeding those to me. So tweet in those questions about archaeology and history in the Americas, and we'll see if we can answer them. All right, we're going to bring on Dr. Monty Dobson. He's an archaeologist and the creator, host, and executive producer of America from the Ground Up. Dr. Dobson holds a PhD in archaeology from the University of York. As a public archaeologist slash historian, he has served in senior and executive roles in museums in the U.S., and the UK. Dr. Monty Dobson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So how's it going?
You know what? Pretty good. spent my morning prepping for this, as a matter of fact. So
excellent. Yeah. Well, you are only the second guest I've ever had on this show, so that's pretty exciting. And hopefully, as I did with the first guest, well, I didn't, luckily, I won't disconnect the call because the equipment is still so somewhat unfamiliar to me. Very different than podcasting.
I nearly had to disconnect anyway. I had to jump off the call real quick as I just called in because one of the funders of a project I'm working on called, and I was like, I'll call you right back.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Well, what we're going to talk about today, as I mentioned in the introduction, is your series, America from the Ground Up. And I'll say it again. You can find it at americasarchaeology.org. And you may have actually seen it on your local PBS station as well. So go check that out.
A bit of shameless self-promotion. You can also watch it streaming on the PBS website.
Outstanding. There you go. Yeah. So, okay. So you have a couple seasons. Let's talk about the show. First, what is the overall thesis of America from the Ground Up? What is this series about?
One of the things that my producing partner, Andrew Devaney, and co-writer, Josh Koenig, that we all wanted to do was to put together a project that looked at American history and American archaeology in an interdisciplinary context, but also that looked at American history and archaeology and particularly colonialism in America in a comparative context. So there are three seasons of this that we plan. Season one, we filmed in Quebec, Montreal, the Great Lakes, and sites along the Mississippi. And we focused primarily on the area and the cultural impact, cultural legacy, if you will, of New France in America. Season two, we filmed in 2017, and it was released 2018. It's still popping up on your local public television stations now. And that looked at the area of impact and the cultural legacy of Spain in America. Okay. And then with the third season, we want to go and pick up the legacy of the British in America. And that'll kind of complete the cycle that we had set out to do.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to run through this. I want to run through the episodes and what this is all about. The first season, now I noticed the second season has a name listed under it, calling it New Spain. At least that's what I saw. Yeah. Does the first season actually have a name, or is it just America from the Ground Up?
It's just America from the Ground Up, because we were never sure that we were ever going to get the chance to do a second one.
So, nice.
It was one of those things where, you know, this was the mad plan all along, but, you know, going into the first season, you never really know for sure if you're ever going to get the chance to do it again.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Sure. Well, so that was, you know, instead of it being subtitled New France, you know, I suspect when the DVD comes out, it'll have those chapter headings tucked in there.
Nice. All right. Well, Before we get really into the show, I like to, anytime I have a guest on the podcast version of this show, I like to sort of set the credentials of the guest. So as I mentioned in your introduction, you do have a PhD in archaeology from the University of York. But really, what's your background in archaeology? What are your primary interests and focus and that kind of led you down this path?
You know, my primary area of research is actually early medieval mortuary monuments, death and burial in sort of 5th to 10th century England.
Okay.
And so, you know, the when I was doing my master's degree in history at Central Michigan University, one of my sort of subfields was Native American history. So that kind of is the sort of opening reason of why I sort of got interested in this project to begin with. So, you know, and the television stuff is really an outgrowth of my experience as a public archaeologist, which is really the track that my career has gone down, is sort of public engagement, interacting with the wider public and science communication.
Okay. And, you know, there's an episode of the archaeology show coming out on the Archaeology Podcast Network tomorrow, actually. That's my interview with you at the conference we were just at, the Society for Historic Archaeology. And if anybody really wants to hear us geek out on producing shows like this and how we can get more stuff done like this and what archaeologists need to do to really get these things on the airwaves in a credible way, listen to that episode because it's really good. Today we're going to focus more on the series, and in that episode we focus more, I think, on the real nuts and bolts of getting something like that done, which is something we need. So much appreciated for you doing this. Okay, well, let's get into the series. So each series, I know the first season one was 6 episodes long, and the first episode is called America's Lost Civilization, Cahokia. What can you tell us about Cahokia? Because this radio station is based out of Carson City, Nevada, even though you can listen anywhere in the world through the internet at knvc.org/listen-live. This is in Carson City, Nevada. So people out here in Nevada might actually not be so aware of Cahokia and what it is. What's the background on Cahokia, and where is it?
You know, Cahokia is a site. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site and a museum that's run by the state of Illinois. And it is a the best way to put it is – I'm sorry. I'm going to sneeze here. Just a second. I'll try not. Sorry.
Live radio. Love it.
So anyway, Cahokia is, in addition to being a UNESCO World Heritage Site, a Native American urban center in the Mississippi bottomlands, if you will, about 8 to 10 miles from downtown St. Louis.
Mm-hmm.
In, let's say, probably about 1150, 1200, I think it's probably at its height or thereabouts. And in I've seen population estimates for the city itself ranging anywhere from 20,000 to 35,000. And if you bring in the sort of, think of it like a city state, if you bring in the surrounding communities, you're probably looking at 50,000.
Mm-hmm. It's huge.
Which is massive. The central mound there is Monk's Mound. It's a platform mound that, let's see, the footprint of it, I think, is 2 acres larger than the Great Pyramid at Giza, and it's taller than a 10-story building.
Yeah, it's daunting when you stand on top of it.
It's incredible. I spent a day walking up and down it, messing up my lines. What I can only describe as searing July heat.
Well, and it's so tall. I mean, you can see, the first time I went there, I was shocked that I could see the arch, the St. Louis Arch, from the top of Monk's Mound. And I'm willing to bet you could see Monk's Mound from the top of the arch. If it's green, though, and covered in grass and kind of blends in with the surroundings, so
exactly.
It's difficult to pick out.
If there was something identifying on that, you certainly could, because we filmed from up there and got great shots of the arch. It's incredible that it's the tallest structure in that stretch between the arch and what's now Collinsville, Illinois.
Yeah, it's amazing. So, all right, well, that's really cool. I mean, I would definitely suggest people go check that out, because you can just walk around that whole thing. They've got some amazing, like, dioramas and reconstructions inside the visitor center, so you can see what it looks like.
Museum.
Yeah,
it is a fabulous museum, well worth a visit, and if you're so inclined, well worth your support. They do incredibly good work.
Yeah, they do indeed. And I think, just to go back to something you mentioned, you know, population at its height of, you know, up to 50,000 people. I mean, people, let's be honest, tend to think of Native American populations in this country as, you know, smaller, you know, teepee rings and all that kind of movie stuff, you know, that we think about. But there were some massive societies that built up here, not just down in Central and South America, you know, the Aztec and the Maya, who we're all used to hearing about, and these monumental archaeology. Sure, the Native Americans here in this country didn't often build stuff out of stone like that in that size, but these earthen mounds that are all over the Ohio Valley and up to Missouri.
And out in, not far from you, out in, you know, there are some Pueblo structures, 1,300 room Pueblos. You know, for when we filmed season two, we were out with the, we were out in the mountains in Arizona mapping, you know, stone Pueblos.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're,
you know, the incredible stuff. So, you know, the unfortunate one size fits all stereotype of Native American communities does nothing, does no justice, if you will, to the diversity and complexity of Native American culture and Native American civilizations throughout what's now the United States and North America.
Right, right.
You know, we unfortunately John Wayne them into a, you know, a one size fits all.
Right. Indeed. Okay. Let me mention one more time, if you're in the Carson Valley or really anywhere in the United States, call in 775-515-4141. We've got two phone lines here. Monty's taken up one of them, so the other one's free and clear for you to ask a question. And you can ask a question about the series or really anything in American archaeology and prehistory, and we'll see if we can't pull our heads together and answer it. So feel free to do that. Also, tweet at Archeowebby, A-R-C-H-E-O-W-E-B-B-Y, and Tristan Boyle is monitoring that for me. All right, so let's move on. The next episode is the fur trade, and I got my undergraduate degree in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and we used to go up to Winnipeg, Canada all the time. And Winnipeg is a hybrid, you know, French-speaking, non-French-speaking town and just littered with fur trade references. In fact, we went to a festival up there at one point over the winter that was all about highlighting the fur trade that came across there. So tell us how the tell us when the fur trade happened and maybe how it influenced development in this country and in Canada.
Boy, that's
a big question.
To be an expert on the fur trade, thanks.
No, overview. You
know,
yeah.
Well, it's one of those things where you know, as different European colonizers turn up in the Americas, you know, in addition to sort of land, you know, one of the things they're looking for is to make a buck, and you know, in I will say with the French, they seem to be, and I'll focus a little more on the French fur trade than, and then maybe touch a bit on the Russian in a minute. But, you know, for the French, they're coming into North America and tapping into these sort of pre-existing, well, not these, into Native American communities. And they begin to interact with Native American, different Native American groups. And you know, as you say, Winnipeg is a site that has a strong French heritage. The Great Lakes were kind of the sort of military heart of the alliance with the Anishinaabeg. And then, and so the, you know, the inland lakes and waterways in North America are utilized by the French and as a sort of weighted network, this, or to put together a network of these pre-existing communities and tap into those relationships. And that you know, that continues for a considerable time. The British get into the game, the Hudson Bay Company, out west, the Russians, and, you know, as they, it's interesting to contrast the, and one of the things we can start to do with this series is we start getting more episodes, is that we can start to draw comparisons between what people were doing and how they did similar things in terms of European colonizers and Native Americans and their those alliances. But also, you know, if you look at the French, the type of fur trade that they're engaged in and the fur trapping is that they're, it's not as intensively destructive environmentally as what we see the Russians engaged in. You know, you can follow the Russian fur trade across Siberia, and they're just devastating the environment all the way through, trapping, you know, killing everything they can get their hands on to maximize the profit. They get into Alaska, and they start doing the same thing. That's one of the reasons you get a colony down at Fort Ross in California, in Sonoma, California. And so, you know, you can kind of see they're trapping out those fur animals in a way that the French don't seem to be.
Right. See, you're an expert on the fur trade.
Ish.
More so than probably most of us listening, I would say. Yes,
there you go.
Yeah.
That's my you've discovered my trick.
That's right.
Just enough to sound lucid, you're good.
Nice. Well, that's why series like this need to exist, though, because a lot of people don't know, or even, I mean, you're not going to get a PhD in the fur trade listening to this or watching the show, but it's going to be information that you didn't know, and probably really... Something like this, and in the way that you've put it together, really helps us understand kind of where we come from. What built this country? Why are we the way we are? And how did we get here? And what are the influences that led to that? And I think if more people understood that history and the different components that come to it, I feel like if we really understood that, we'd be a little more tolerant in this world about other cultures and other societies and other ideas, knowing that we came together like that.
Yeah, that's exactly one of the reasons that I undertook the project. You know, we wanted to create a project that's going to be accessible to the public, but that's also going to be presenting current ongoing research as well as the results of previous research. And then in its own right, it becomes a research project because it is a comparative analysis of those different colonial systems. And what we need to realize is that, you know, we have this impression in America that American history begins and ends in Boston, Philadelphia, and Virginia.
Yeah.
And, you know, you and I'm in Missouri right now, and you're sitting in Nevada. We're in New Spain.
Yeah.
Here in Missouri, it was part of New France.
Right.
So, you know, the colonial histories of America, and history plural there, are different, but also I think what we do is the danger of presenting that monolithic British version is that we lose sight of the richness of the things that we've inherited from all of the groups. Now, you know, the bad things as well. We're certainly never going to gloss over, you know, the kinds of the negative impact that colonization has had on Native peoples in North America.
Right,
that's,
absolutely.
You know, that's a strong theme of the series as well. But at the same time, I'm really interested in looking at Native peoples as indigenous peoples, if you will, as geopolitical actors in their own right. You know, they have an agenda. They have a geopolitical outlook that involves themselves, the peoples immediately around them, other tribal, intertribal and extra-tribal alliances, and then alliances that that cut across some of the European colonization. So, you know, and I think to me, when we think about history in those terms, and we think about archaeology as a way to investigate those stories, the past opens up as a really rich and interesting story.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, you were mentioning the history and the New Spain and New France. And I wanted to touch back on that for a second, because it's always interesting to me. And this is going to get into the next two episodes from the series is, you know, how Spain, France, and to an even greater extent, England, they managed to hang on for a long time to their other colonies around the world. You know, the places where they came in and colonized and hung on. Yet the scrappy people that came over here kind of didn't stand for that for too long and said, let's do this and take the country. And the England just couldn't hang with that. And apparently neither could anybody else. And so the next two series cover that with the episode 3 with the French and Indian War and episode 4 with America's War for Independence. So can you tell us what's covered in those two episodes?
Sure. In those two episodes, and if, as you watch throughout the series as a whole, you'll see different parts, elements of that story put together. And I wanted to craft those particularly, if you will, we think of them as particularly American stories. The Seven Years' War, the American Revolution, the French, the War of 1812, these are all parts of European, they're all tied into European colonial wars.
Right.
And that's what I'm really trying to get at in those episodes of, you know, how can we look to the archaeology to better understand what people are doing in these places at this time?
Mm-hmm.
And so, so that's kind of, you know, that's the main focus of that. And, you know, as we get into the final season, we're going to look at how, you know, this British legacy. You know, yes, the United States has an American Revolution. Well, it's tied to I guess I'll oversimplify it and call it British colonial policy,
right.
Which, if you want to strip it down to a bare bones, it's settlement and land clearance.
Okay.
And so the driving forces, if you think about those two episodes that you just talked about, actually those three, the driving force of the 7 Years' War to begin with, or the French and Indian War, is settlement in the Ohio Valley. The French want to get in there and exploit resources, and they're encroaching in that space on the native alliance, geopolitical alliance, the Iroquois, with the British. Mm-hmm. And the British want to, you know, the British / American colonists, British colonists really, because they would have never said they weren't, they were British colonists, want to settle in that space.
Yeah.
So at the end of that war, 7 Years' War, as a way to placate their native allies, the British basically forbid settlement west of the Appalachians.
Okay.
And so when you start thinking about all of these landless people in the, you know, stacked up in what is a rapidly overpopulating, if you will, British colony, they want to be able to settle in that land. This is one of the major agitators for what becomes the American Revolution.
Right.
We move forward a few decades, and we're into the War of 1812. Similar issues. We're talking settlement in Ohio country. Mm-hmm. And so it really, those, that idea of settlement, land clearance, and to an extent westward migration are really being driven by, or really I should say are the driving forces, I think, in the American story. And so, you know, by marrying up multiple different archaeological sites, we can tie those pieces together and start looking at this question, this dynamic, comparatively.
You know, I can think of some places to go to see the America's War for Independence segment. I can think of some places. I don't have a lot of experience with the East Coast, but I can definitely think of some places I would go to sort of see firsthand where these conflicts took place. But with obviously this being a TV series, it's highly visual. So I really have no concept in my mind where I would even go to see examples of the French and Indian War. Where did you go to cover this in the show? How did you do that visually?
And this is a good question because this gets to how do you make these things. One thing there, television is ridiculously, ruinously, hideously expensive. that's the layman's term for. I suppose.
Right.
Or the professional term. It is very expensive. We have never had the kind of budget that would allow us to do things like recreations, CGI, and that sort of thing. It's just outside of our budget. So, you know, one of those drivers is that I want to find places that are visual, that are strong examples of the kinds of social dynamic that we're examining and talking about. One of the places that we filmed was Fort Ticonderoga. That's a fort that's, you know, important. It was Crown Point, and before that, it's, you know, a number of other, it has a couple of other names because it changes hands between, you know, it's British, it's American. It just has, so it has a rich history in that space. Right. It's also gorgeous. That does not hurt.
And where is that?
Yeah. That's Fort Ticonderoga, giant stone fort sitting on Lake Champlain.
Ah, Lake Champlain. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is another reason for another thing that drives where we choose to go. One of the things that we're doing with this is we're decentering the American story on a grand scale in that we're looking at the French first, the Spanish second, and then the British. But also, we flip these sites inside out, or we flip these ideas inside out, and we try to look at frontiers and borderlands mm-hmm. as zones of interaction between different people groups, because that's where I think we can start to get to some really interesting data, some really interesting ideas about what people are doing is in the places where they're bumping up against each other.
Right.
So that's another driver for a site that we select. So, you know, our American Revolution episode, if you will, features sites. We start out in Quebec, at the Plains of Abraham, and we work our way down through the region of Lake Champlain and talk about that area that really is, in the American mindset, an afterthought. But actually, it's one of the most important zones of interaction between the British and the Americans in the entire war.
Hmm. Nice. Okay. All right. Well, let me take a second here to remind everybody, especially you guys listening in the Carson Valley on KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media, to call in at 775. I always lose the phone number. 775-515-4141. And you can call that number from really anywhere in the country and probably Canada, too. So call in if you happen to be listening from up there. And if you are not listening online and you want to, knvc.org/listen-live will get you there. You can also tweet at Archeowebby, ArcheoWebby, and at ArcPodNet, ArcPodNet. And be sure to check out KNVC on Twitter, KNVC_radio. And Dr. Monty Dobson, you're also on Twitter at Lemont, LEMONT. That's right?
Yes, sure.
Okay. Perfect.
My name. At me.
At him. That's right. I'm surprised you're not famous enough that it's not at the real Lamont. That's when you know you've made it.
Oh, you see, that's what I needed to go for, was at the real Lamont. Yes.
That's right.
Not,
because
not the fake Lamont that's out there.
All those Lamont posers out there can just, you know. All right. So I thought it was interesting, and I want to get your take on this as we go back to the show here. You end the series with the War of 1812, but you pop in this episode called The Science of Archaeology right in the middle there. What is the reasoning behind that sort of scheduling, and what do you cover in that episode?
I wanted to do the science episode because, one, I'm a science nerd, and we had these terrific interview segments that were too long to fit in those narrative episodes. Some, you know, little bits and pieces of them were, but there was so much more that depth and richness that I really wanted to talk about. So, you know, what we did was we carved out that space for that episode. Part of the reason we could do that is, as this was originally conceived, and this will give you some idea of how these ideas evolve, it was going to be 4 1-hour episodes mm-hmm. that we were looking to film. It came about in the editing process that it works better as a half hour episode, but it's also budget driven. I think sometimes we would have the idea that these decisions would be very elegant and driven by, you know, data, or they might be driven by this. But at a certain point, it's really as elegant as a meat axe. You can only do what you have the money to do.
Right.
So instead of, you know, we wanted to film an episode about the Civil War, which would have been problematic in retrospect. It never would have worked, and we shouldn't have thought about going that far forward. It just didn't work. So reconfiguring it as half-hour episodes, I had that space. Now, we could have sent out 5 episodes, and that would have been fine. Mm-hmm. But we also had the luxury of having all of this great footage and the space to do it. And, it, you know, 6 episodes was a nice, neat package that we could send out to public television stations. And they tend, you know, people tend to like even numbers mm-hmm. so in those series. So that, you know, for a lot of reasons, that episode came about. But that's one of the ones I'm happiest with, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed putting that together.
Yeah, that's really cool. Because one of the things I learned when we interviewed some people from Time Team, not only the Time Team America series that was somewhat disappointingly short-lived, I wish they could have kept that going, but also we interviewed somebody who was on or part of for a little time Time Team BBC, the original Time Team, which ran for, I don't know, something like 20 plus years. I mean, it was a long time.
Yeah, oh, it was for ages. Yeah.
Yeah. They said on that, I remember them saying that you could ask like the average British citizen, because it was a really popular show, you could ask the average British citizen what ground penetrating radar was, and they would know what it is.
And they would know.
You ask the average American, yeah, and they're like, I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
No, it was one of the most brilliant science communication, public archaeology projects, public history projects that I've seen. And it was on a commercial network.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hugely popular.
Yeah.
So I gets me to my, you know, one of my axes up to grind. I think there's room for really solid research-based archaeology and history on network television.
Sure.
On commercial television.
Yeah.
You know, the hindrance to that is it's expensive and it's hard to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay, well, you end the series with episode 6 and the War of 1812. So, you know, give me a 4-minute rundown of the War of 1812. what do you cover in the show?
We really look at trying to look at the War of 1812 in the context of continuing competition between Britain and the United States for what was the old Northwest Territory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Britain is funneling guns to Native Americans in the Ohio Valley as a way to destabilize the region. They're striking alliances with Tecumseh and Pensacola and his brother, who's also known as the Prophet. And I wanted to follow that dynamic and kind of follow the trajectory of the war, but in the Great Lakes region, in the old Northwest Territory, which is what it was about, because, you know, Britain was supposed to leave that region at the end of the Revolution, but didn't.
Right.
Well, marginally didn't. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure on American politicians to both to go to war and then not to. But again, it comes down to issues of settlement. You know, there are people who want, there are European Americans who want to settle in that land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are Native Americans who want to turn that same Ohio country into a Native homeland.
Sure.
So, and then we follow that through. You know, one of the things that fascinates me is the naval war on the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't think about, you know, massive, you know, tall warships on the Great Lakes engaged in battle, but that's exactly what was happening.
Right. That seems so crazy.
Yeah, and our timing was perfect. We got to work with another two other production companies, actually, who were also filming various aspects of that battle, that recreated battle on the Great Lakes. And we worked with the National Park Service, and we all kind of swapped out film, and so it worked out brilliantly.
Nice.
And I could never afford to do that kind of recreation on my own. So,
yeah,
you know, we leveraged those kind of partnerships to do it.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to talk about season 2 next. Season 2 just released this last year, so it's hot off the press, and you can get on it. But
it is somewhere. It is on your local public television station now.
That's right. That's right. Check it out and look for it. And especially a lot of people are digital these days. And like you said, go to the PBS app, or if you have Apple TV, there's a pretty great PBS app for Apple TV that you can check out. And a lot of stuff you can see. The Apple TV app for PBS really kind of floors me a little bit, because all these guys still require like a cable login to see some stuff. But the PBS app has a lot more stuff that you can just watch without a cable login. I'm like, if I'm a cord cutter, why am I going to have a cable TV like login subscription? That doesn't make any sense. But
right.
That being said.
And just to let everyone know, ours is outside of the PBS. It's not a paywall, but it kind of is.
Yeah.
It's their membership thing, where if you're a member, you can see more.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Ours is not part of that. We make it freely available to by partnering with my production partners on this, Central Michigan University and WCMU Public Media.
Mm-hmm.
The goal, the reason I did that and the goal for that is we make it freely available to anybody within the United States that wants to watch it, but it's also there for use in schools and in universities.
Right.
Just to wrap up season one, if you watch season one from start to finish, you'll get those individual episodes, you'll get the American story, but you'll also get a introductory course in archaeological field methods.
Nice.
So in each episode, there are little kind of not pop-out vignettes because they're organically built within the interview sections. But we walk people through how you conduct an investigation, an archaeological excavation.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Similar thing is happening in season three, where we're looking at how you identify an archaeological site.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to talk about future seasons here in a second.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned earlier, season two is called New Spain. So let's get into this. Episode one is called The Ancestors. Where do you head for that one? This is the one where you go to the Southwest?
Yeah. Every season opens up with a assessment of what are Native peoples doing in this landscape, in this space before Europeans turn up. And then we try to follow those narratives through to a logical conclusion throughout the episodes. So the first episode opens up. It's actually a pretty broad swath. The question I wanted to look at is, how are Native peoples altering the landscape? Mm-hmm. You know, what are they building? And how are they using the landscape around them? So we start out down at Watson Break and Poverty Point, which are two very large mound complexes very early in Louisiana.
Yeah.
You know, Poverty Point, well, both of them, but Poverty Point is a site that, you know, if the standard model of who builds large monumental and urban structures, you know, it stands it a bit on its head because, by all accounts, these are hunter-gatherers doing this kind of complex activity.
Yeah. So, over many years.
Yeah. Yeah. And in some cases, very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, so it just, you know, we start with that, and then we jump out to the Southwest, and we start out with Chuck Riggs, who's an archaeologist out at Fort Lewis College, and one of his excavations where he's not far from Mesa Verde, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Probably only about 5 miles, but as you know, as the crow flies, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But he was excavating a couple of unit pueblos, and with his field school, and then we kind of follow that. We start there, and we kind of trace that story of the pueblo migration through the story of the Jemez Pueblo people over the course of that episode. So. You know, we kind of work our way down through some of the places that they would have moved through. And then we kind of end out at the Jemez Pueblo site with Marlon Magdalena, who's a Jemez Pueblo enrolled member, and he's also a historian with the I think it's Historic New Mexico or New Mexico Historic. I can't remember. But and then Chris Toya, who is the archives and records guy, and I think he does the NAGPRA stuff. He's an archaeologist, but he's Jemez Pueblo, and he works for the Jemez Pueblo.
Okay.
And so just got their story of the Pueblo migration.
Mm-hmm.
And then that puts us on the sort of eve of the arrival of Spain in this part of the world.
Okay, and that explains why New Spain, the title of the series, is actually the second episode. But you know, before we head into that, you know, I got to mention I did a bunch of work on as a cultural resource management archaeologist down in the New Mexico area, and actually we were staying, my wife and I, near Chaco Canyon, and we were actually at this ranch house that was maybe 45, 50 miles from Chaco Canyon, and so on our time off, we worked a 9-on-5 off schedule, so we had a lot of days off in a row, and we went out to Chaco Canyon, and I was like, you know, when we first got there, I was like, oh, cool, Chaco Canyon. We'll probably hit out there our first 5-day rotation break, and then the second one, we'll go see something else. But I mean, we saw with the hikes. I mean, it's like an 8-mile hike out and back to get to some of these things, and even farther in some cases, and to get to some of these pueblos that are out there. And it was just, it was amazing, the architecture, and I can't even imagine what Chaco Canyon looked like back in the day when this was just at the height of its activity, when Pueblo Bonita, which is the really big one near the visitor center that everybody goes to, and then the ones up on the ridge, and they're just all through the entire canyon area there. It's just such an amazing, phenomenal place, and you just can't imagine. You can't imagine anybody even now building something like that, let alone, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Right, and there are, you know, Pueblo towns across that part of the world, from Arizona, New Mexico, from Colorado on down.
Yeah.
And so you know, and that was one of the things I wanted to do, was show some diversity in that as well. That's why we went out with some folks from a number of different places. And we were working, mapping a Pueblo site on the White Mountain Apache Reservation in an alpine environment. Most mm-hmm. people, if you think Pueblo, they're like, oh, it's this. Well, it's not all desert. You know, here we have, yeah. you know, we were at a 600-unit Pueblo in an alpine environment, surrounded by forest and water and all of those things that you wouldn't necessarily associate with.
Right. Yeah, and that's, it's amazing. And it's, as we study history too, and we try to not only figure out what was going on in the past, but probably try to learn from it. Chaco Canyon and that whole, they call it the Chaco and Outliers, like communities that are associated with Chaco Canyon. It's a demonstration in resources too, because I think it's still pretty much common understanding that one of the reasons that declined so suddenly over the course of not very many years is because of massive resource depletion. There were too many people, not enough wood, not enough water, not enough food.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's something that too, that I think is important for us to talk about as archaeologists, as public archaeologists, which we both do. And, mm-hmm. and that is that, what can we learn from the studying the past that's going to help us understand what we're doing today?
Yeah.
You know, everything from, as you say, the resource depletion, going back to look at Cahokia, one of the reasons Cahokia depopulates, or one of I would say the most plausible theory for why Cahokia depopulates and is ultimately abandoned is exactly that, resource depletion, because the population of that site became too intensified and too large for it to be supported by the surrounding area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And, you know, they didn't have weather forecasters and climate scientists and all these other things. And we do, and we still don't listen to them. But that's another show entirely.
We don't know the difference between weather and climate.
That's right.
So I always, you know, I get into this argument with people, and I'm like, no, weather is when you stick your head out the window, and if it's raining, you have wet hair.
Yeah.
Climate is the weather over decades across the whole region or the planet.
Exactly. I have a friend who works for the National Weather Service here, and he's probably tired of having those conversations, I would imagine. Yeah. So, all right. So the next two episodes, I think we'll talk about those together, because New Spain, as you mentioned, when the Spanish start coming into the West here and really kind of dominating, I mean, half the towns in California start with the word mission as their name. So,
yes.
You know, that's that influence right there. And then Worlds Collide, I'm sure, is the Spanish coming in where they're not welcome. So let's talk about those.
Well, it's all of those things. You know, those two episodes, what I wanted to do was set up a contrast in terms of the vastness of the size of the holding, and contrasting that with sort of French colonial holdings at that, you know, and the competition with the French, but also, you know, the British, and you know, the different ways of having to navigate that landscape. Where the French were able, because of the geography, the topography, the rivers and lakes of the region, were able to use those as water highways.
Mm-hmm.
The Spanish didn't necessarily have that in the interior of their colonies. You know, if you want to make it from Mexico City to Santa Fe, you've got a long trek to make over a vast stretch of, in some places, pretty inhospitable desert.
Yeah.
And that journey can take weeks and sometimes months.
I mean, it's inhospitable driving across that landscape sometimes, let alone on horseback or walking.
Yeah. We were out on a stretch, and this is where my terrible, bad high school Spanish will fail me. We filmed out on the White Sands Range area in advance of some road improvements for mm-hmm. Spaceport America with Elizabeth Oster, and she was mapping stretches of the Jornada del Muerto
mm-hmm.
where there were some pottery scatters. You know, the interesting thing was, we were looking at Spanish olive jars over top of prehistoric stuff, including one that's like a sort of pestle.
Okay.
Which, it's an area where people are gathering, you know, these seeds and things that they can eat in this inhospitable area. And, you know, people leave this behind because they're not carrying it with them. They don't want to carry it with them.
Yeah.
So there, people are using the landscape in similar ways across time. You know, if it's good for one person, one group of people to stop there and eat because there are resources available, that's what other people are going to do. Because
right.
that's kind of one of the only spots you're going to find. So,
yeah, indeed.
So we were looking at those roadways and how they connect up people and places. And Spanish interaction with native peoples, but also with other European colonizers, and those some of the complexity of those relationships. One of the things that we talk about in season three is the the alliances between the Apache and the Comanche and the French and the Spanish,
mm-hmm.
and how those play out geopolitically on the frontier of New Spain.
Okay. All right. Well, we've got about. We got about 12 or so minutes left, 12 or 13 minutes left. So I want to get through the rest of the season and talk about what the future mm-hmm. of this series is. So quickly give us a recap. What's Paradise Lost about episode 4 and season 2?
Yeah. And in episode 4, I had wanted to do an episode on about slavery. But one of the things that annoys me often about public discussion of enslavement in the American context is we always get fully formed, fully agri-industrial plantation system in the antebellum South.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I wanted to address in that, and it ties right into the theme, is, well, how did we get there? And the answer to that really begins in the Mediterranean and on the Iberian Peninsula with the plantation system that the Spanish develop and export to the New World, and also that taste for sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those have roots in Spain. And so we follow that question that we're answering in the series, which is, how is it that people from sub-Saharan Africa not only become seen as suitable for enslavement, mm-hmm. but wholly suitable for enslavement?
Right.
And that's where, and so we follow that question throughout, and then we end down at the Levi Jordan plantation in Texas with Ken Brown, who's an archaeologist down at Houston. And he excavated the slave quarters there on what is a sugar plantation in East Texas. And so we ended up, we're talking about, okay, well, here's the background of how we got here. And here's what these folks' lives are like, the enslaved component of this plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the next episode is the fifth episode is the Civil War. I wanted to do, as I said, that in the first season and never really got the chance. And so it fits much better within our remit to do it this season, in season two, because we got to look at the Civil War as it played out in Missouri primarily, in the Trans-Mississippi West. And the Civil War is part of that legacy, that cultural legacy of enslavement that's imported in the New World by Spain.
Yeah.
So we follow that episode through to the conclusion of the war in what's now Missouri and in the West anyway, mm-hmm. and that gets us on to the final episode where we really kind of wrap up and we look at the westward expansion of the United States post Civil War. But predominantly rather than starting at the Mississippi River and heading west, we kind of go back down to the border, what's now the border, and go to New Spain before it's America or mm-hmm. Mexico and then America. And we kind of follow that the Europeanization, if you will, or the European colonization of the Southwest and its impact, and follow it up to we end that episode on the White Mountain Apache Reservation, talking to their tribal historian, Ramon Riley, and discussing with him the cultural impact and the impact on the White Mountain Apache people of American reservation policy.
Mm-hmm.
So there we're in the 1890s, and we've kind of ended that season. Next season, we're going to go back and we're going to pick up the British in North America. We're in the process of writing that now and selecting sites.
Okay.
We were at the SHAs. I met with a couple of people who are doing some excavations this next summer that we hope to go film at, funding God's willing.
All right. Well, I'm going to put out the phone number one more time in case anybody wants to call in. Just so everybody knows, I do a podcast, and I podcast a lot, but this actual show is a podcast called The Archaeology Show on the Archaeology Podcast Network, and you can find that at archpodnet.com/archaeology, and you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Podcasts, and Spotify as well. But, you know, for anybody that listens to podcasts, you'll know that one of the downsides to a podcast is it's kind of a one-way conversation. I mean, you're interviewing somebody, but there's no interaction with the audience. And the reason I wanted to do this radio show was to have interaction with the audience. So I want to encourage people to call in about literally anything. I mean, feel free to interrupt us. We just like to, Monty, can you and I, we just talk about archaeology all day long, pretty much, right?
I can talk all day long, probably by myself. So yeah,
right?
It's great to have a conversation with other people.
I know. My first episode here that was live was just me talking, and I was like, I even doubted myself, will I be able to do that? And sure enough, I probably could have gone another couple hours. So,
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So call in 775-515-4141, and Tristan Boyle at an archaeologist is monitoring the Twitter feed and the Facebook feed. So I'm just going to keep putting those out there so you guys can get used to the fact that we're here. It's going to be every Friday from 12 to 1 Pacific time. And we're going to keep this going as long as we can. So I want to go back to, Monty, just a couple episodes back when you were talking about the Civil War. It's really, and you mentioned this, the ability for people to just see sub-Saharan Africa as a place where you can get slaves and just kind of be okay with that. It's like the most of the world, it seemed, that was into the, that was doing slavery, at least most of the Western world. They seem to be, I mean, I'm sure there were people like now, you know, anytime you have something, there's always people that are on the other side of it saying, hey, we shouldn't be doing this. And this is how we eventually abolished slavery, was those voices started to get louder and louder and louder, culminates in the Civil War. And then finally, you know, there were many decades of struggle after that, but that was, of course, where it started to diminish. And it's amazing to me how people that are used to a certain lifestyle can get used to certain behaviors that and another time frame you would see as very objectionable, or if not disgusting. And I look at the parallels between that and today, where the modern day, I mean, I'm not going to diminish slavery at all by saying this, so don't think I am, but modern day business people, right? Really successful business people are living a certain lifestyle. And sometimes it's hard for them to see how hard it is for the people working under them at the lowest levels of their company, how much of a struggle it is for them to survive while you're sitting on your yacht or flying from one place to the next in your private jet, you know, with your 16 houses. And it's hard for people to see, because they're living this lifestyle, what's going on. It's another place where we can learn from history. I mean, it's just phenomenal, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the past is full of a lot of those kinds of stories and analogies, yeah, where we can, you know, where we can learn about, you know, how our actions might play out today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, you know, one of the things that that I wanted to accomplish with that particular episode was get at this question of, you know, we have in America today a situation where, you know, if you're Black, there's an assumed criminality often associated, mm-hmm, with that. Where does this stupidity come from?
Right.
And it's a cultural legacy that just hangs on. If you imagine the sort of, you know, in the antebellum South, in communities where the enslaved population outnumbers the white population, there is a fear of a slave revolt. And this assumption that, or, and this very real need, actually, if you're going to keep people enslaved, of enforcing that system. And that, you know, that gets all melded together with a ton of different bad ideas from throughout history, and it becomes what we now call racism.
Yeah.
You know, and if we don't understand that, and we don't understand ourselves and how we got here, we have no hope of getting out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my goal with that episode, was to kind of do a lot of that heavy lifting and have those really difficult conversations in a way that was, you know, hopefully informative for people. For me, that was one of the hardest episodes that I ever had, that I had to write.
Wow.
It's just not a topic I'm comfortable dwelling in.
Yeah.
For a lot of reasons. I don't like inhumanity. I don't like thinking about, you know, what the horrible things we do to each other. And then that particular episode, I spent, you know, several months specifically thinking about the horrible things we do to each other.
Well, it's good. It's good that you did it, because sometimes to get through the hard times, we need to be uncomfortable. That's for sure.
Well, exactly. Exactly. So, just because something makes you uncomfortable doesn't mean there's a reason not to do it. It's very often the reason you should go do that.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, we mentioned that there's going to be a season three. And are there more seasons planned after that? Or are you kind of looking to season three as the end of this series?
As it sits now, season three is going to be, I think, the end of America from the ground up.
Okay.
The title of the website is a bit of a hint at where we're hoping to go with it next. I want to expand the time slot to an hour and do slightly longer stories about America's archaeology as a whole. And so we expand this idea of thinking about pre-colonized, colonized, and post-colonized spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And we look at all of the Americas, from, you know, South America to Canada.
Okay.
And we, you know, so that's my hope, is that this continues on, but in an expanded form. I want to kind of follow that same model, and each season looking at a particular story or theme,
right,
but we'll expand it out to a longer format.
Okay. Well, in the last 2 minutes, that leads right into, you know, Tristan Boyle over in Scotland. He's asked a question, and this leads right into that. He says, what impact do you think America from the ground up will have on programming? Is there any hope for other shows like it, besides what you want to do to follow on to this?
I think so. I hope we've done something that other people can look at and get an idea of how you put together a complex story around research-based archaeology. Yeah. You know, that gets to the point of why I started a production company myself. It's hard to sell research-based archaeology as a topic to mm-hmm. television networks and commissioners.
Yeah.
The people who commission programs, because it takes a long time and it costs a lot of money. And very often commercial production companies don't have archaeologists on staff, and they don't really know how to do this stuff.
Right.
So, shameless plug, I have an Indiegogo campaign right now trying to kickstart the funding for season three. So,
okay.
There you are.
Hey, let's put the address out for that. What's it called? So people can find it.
If you do Indiegogo and America from the ground up, you'll see it. If you look at my Twitter page, you'll see it pinned to the top of my Twitter at Lamont.
Okay.
It'll be on the website as soon as I update it over the weekend. It's on our Facebook page right now, America from the Ground Up Facebook, and that'll get you there.
So, okay. All right.
Support us. Last thing I'll say, I know we're running out of time. Each season costs us about $250,000 to do.
Yeah.
And
all
that's
right.
Cheap for television. So there you go.
That is cheap. All right. Well, everybody, let's pull together, go to those resources, and go to that Indiegogo, type in America from the ground up, and donate. And thank you again, Dr. Monty Dobson, for coming on the show today and talking about America from the ground up. Yes. And thank you for doing this. Yeah. And I hope we get season three out. So check it out at americasarchaeology.org. You can check it out on your local PBS station. And I will finish this out by saying, you know, you can always catch more of these episodes at The Archaeology Show on arcpodnet.com. I'll be here every Friday from 12 to 1. I don't even know when. From 12 to 1 Pacific time here in the studio. So you can always call in at 775-515-4141. Feel free to always ask me a question at my Twitter handle, at Archeowebby, ArcheoWebby. Follow KNVC_radio on Twitter. Follow ArcPodNet on Twitter for all the latest updates. And, you know, we hope to hear from you soon. I want this to be a call-in show where people can talk about archaeology. They can talk about something they found that was interesting, some question they have about history, and we can try to give you the answers. I don't have all the answers, but I love talking about it, and I love discussing those things. So definitely call in next time. Send in your questions ahead of time. You can email them chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com and go from there. All right, until next time, we'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show on KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.